I'm Graham Nystrom, and we have some special programming today. Very happy to have in the studio Mr. Jonathan White, author of Tides, the Spirit and Science of the Ocean. Let's see. It sounds like you're on a pretty rigorous speaking tour in support of your book. We're very fortunate to have you in the studio with us, so welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Graham. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so tonight's speaking event is at the Level Showroom at 7 p.m., and that is brought to you by the North Coast Watershed Association. So the Level Showroom is part of the Fort George Brewery at 14th and Duane in downtown Astoria. Come meet Jonathan, get a copy of his book, and celebrate this release on a maritime topic that affects everyone here on the coast and lower Columbia waters. And that's if you're a commercial fisherman, a longshoreman, a coast guard, bar pilot, river pilot, captain of a ferry, surfer, or even just a beachgoer, your life is intertwined with the regular twice daily tide. So, Jonathan, you've had quite a life. Tell me about yourself. And I'm particularly fascinated with your sailing experience and the activities you had on your schooner, the Crusader.
Yeah, thank you. I grew up on the California coast surfing and diving and sailing and so forth. And I actually went to Lewis and Clark College just up the river. And after I graduated there, I built a 26-foot sloop and sailed it around the Pacific, Atlantic, and Caribbean. And then in the early 80s, I came back up to Seattle and I ended up buying a big old wooden schooner, a halibut schooner, that was actually down in Tillamook when I bought her. And started a nonprofit educational organization on the boat. And we did seminars up and down the coast from Seattle to Southeast Alaska and around Haida Gwaii and Vancouver Island for about 11 years. So lots of experiences up and down the coast. And I almost lost the boat in a large Alaskan tide and gale up in Kruzoff Island out just near Sitka. And that's really got me started on this book project.
I read about that experience. That sounded pretty intense. And it reminded me of the Farley Mowat book about marine salvage. And, you know, you had pumps loaded aboard and wow.
Yeah.
And so real quick, you're that 26-foot sloop, you just told me that you brought it from Portland to Astoria and you sailed over the bar a couple times, and that was quite an experience for you.
That's right. It's kind of like piercing your ear when you go across the equator. It's going across the Columbia River Bar is a noteworthy sailing experience.
It's kind of one of the big ones in the world, right?
It's a big one in the world, and I launched the boat in Portland and sailed it down here, and I remember I was thinking about crossing that bar for a long, long time before I actually crossed it. And luckily, I got the tides right, and it was uneventful, but it was still a remarkable experience in my sailing life.
Yeah, I suspect that if you don't get the tides right, you're just not going to get anywhere.
It's a whole nother story.
Or you're going to hit some standing waves and start surfing, and yeah. Okay, cool. And so the experience on the schooner got you interested in the tides. Tell us a little bit about the title. You say the Spirit and Science of the Ocean. So where did you get the subtitle there?
Well, it is interesting because that subtitle didn't come till later, and it wasn't like I started out to write a book that covered the science and the spirit of the ocean. But the more I researched, the more people I met and discovered their relationships with the tide, multidimensional, both cultural and mythological and spiritual and scientific, the subtitle seemed clear that that's really what I was trying to do, is bring in all of these stories into that experience of journeying to understand the tides.
That's one of the really neat things about the book, is how informative it is about so many aspects of this, because it's not just some purely scientific thing with one general rule and it's the same every time. And then just sort of the evolution of what we as humans know about the tides and what causes them and what causes those anomalies as well. And so there's mythology, there's poetry, there's cultural histories. It's really an interesting read in so many ways. You know, I learned things about Kepler and Galileo and Newton, and I learned things about, you know, what the Chinese thought about their tidal bore on which river is that?
The Chentong River.
The Chentong River, yeah. So twice daily, a huge tidal bore run. It's like 80 miles up the river, right? And
yeah, it's the largest tidal bore in the world. And a tidal bore is when the tide comes up a river in the form of a wave or a solid wall of water. And there's actually more of these around the world than most of us think. There's a one up in Alaska, a famous one up in the Brook Peninsula area. And there's a 15-foot one that goes up the Amazon that can be felt 500 miles up that river. And there's a number of them around the Bay of Fundy in the UK, but the largest one in the world is on the Chentong River in China. And I went there several times, but it gets up to 25 feet tall. And it's come up that river on every tide twice a day for 2,500 years. So there's a lot of mythology and poetry and science around this tide. In fact, the first tide chart came out of there in the 1000 AD, which is 200 years earlier than the first tide chart appeared in the West.
Hmm. Yeah, I have a little bit of experience studying some of, you know, China's culture and philosophies and histories, and they are just so poetic and, you know, beautifully metaphorical in their grasp of things, all things natural. And so, you know, to some it was a dragon, and to others it was horses. And then wasn't it, let's see, Leonardo da Vinci thought that there was a giant creature that was breathing under the ocean, and he was trying to calculate the size of the lung. Was that Da Vinci?
Yeah, Leonardo da Vinci, and there was a lot
Who's not Chinese, by the way? I kind of skipped there.
Yeah. Well, now you're talking about kind of some of the historical thoughts about the tide. And it's very interesting, I think, that for 99% of human history, we had no idea how the tides work. I mean, it really wasn't until the end of the scientific revolution, 1700, that Newton and some of his colleagues gave us the laws of planetary motion and gravity that gave us just a finger hold on how the tides work. And it took us, you know, it's taken us 300 years since then to figure out what we know today. We don't know everything today. We know a lot. But for all those years before Newton, for sure, our ancestors who lived on the coast had a very keen, practical understanding of the tides, the relationship between what they could see and the tides. For example, the full moon or the new moon meant large tides, meaning high highs and low lows. So they surely had a developed practical understanding that they passed on from father to son or generation to generation, but they didn't know how it worked.
Yeah, there's a difference that you mentioned between observing the connection that when the moon is full, the tides are large, and when the moon is new, the tides are large. But the actual causality was another leap that had to be made, rather than just the synchronicity of those things.
Exactly, and there, like you mentioned, Leonardo da Vinci, there was a lot of speculation about what was going on. Like some people thought that the moon heated rocks on the bottom of the ocean. And then when those rocks heated, it made the ocean swell. Or when the moon went away, it cooled the rocks and the water contracted, and that was low tide. Mm-hmm. Or that it was a breathing of the earth itself, or the breathing of a giant beast like Leonardo da Vinci thought. And as you said, he tried to calculate the size of its lung. But there was a lot of speculation about, as you can imagine, you know, as we would do too if we were sitting on the coast here and we didn't know how it worked.
I was particularly interested by the fact that Newton hardly ever even saw the ocean, right? Didn't you say he stayed kind of in his little Cambridge and wherever else? And
yeah, there's good evidence that he never saw the ocean.
That's incredible.
Yeah, he came up with the first scientific theory, the first credible scientific theory that we still adhere to today. It's not correct completely, but it's called the equilibrium theory. But it's a fundamental theory that we still base the way we look at the tides today.
So Newton is a big player in the story here of what we know today. Are there any other kind of major turning points or major players in what we know about the tides that you can talk about?
Well, there are a number of them, kind of trail markers along the way. One of the thinkers, Kepler, German scientists of just earlier than Newton and a contemporary of Galileo, he was really one of the first to look at gravity. And until that time, gravity, we still don't really know what gravity is, but it's interesting. Gravity has a really, really interesting history and plays into this whole development about tide theory pretty precisely. For example, Aristotle thought that gravity was just an inherent nature within something that it wanted to fall or return to Earth. And Kepler called it soul. So he said it was the soul of the apple that wanted it to fall to the earth or return to the earth. And Newton, and in fact a lot of the scientists during Newton's time, they didn't want anything to do with gravity because it was this kind of black magic, invisible force, right, that could reach out over all this distance and stir, for example, the waters of the earth. But it was a very spooky an unknown thing and unknowable in a lot of ways. So the new scientists ushering into the modern era, they didn't want anything to do with this, but they finally had to accept it. And Newton plunked it right in the middle of his theory, but he said, I don't want anything to do with this. You know, please don't blame me for this. But anyway, it's a very interesting, you can track gravity itself and the evolution of tides, and it's a pretty fascinating story.
Remind me who it was that talked about laziness.
That was Kepler.
Okay.
Yeah, that was Kepler. Because, of course, he thought if the moon is circling the earth, then why doesn't it fall into the earth? And he said that, well, actually, it's because there's a certain laziness about it wanting to respond to that kind of force, gravity, of course. Gravity, by the way, is a very pervasive, but it's a very weak force. Mm-hmm. There are lots of forces, electromagnetic, for example, they're much, much stronger forces. So it's a pretty weak force, but pervasive.
Do electromagnetic forces act on the tides?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the moon exerts a gravitational force and pulls the tides, but then the sun also does as well, but it's a quarter of the strength of the moon? Is that
half.
Right? Half. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I read the book, I promise. Okay, so just to sort of regroup here, tell the listeners what they can expect at tonight's event at the Lovell Showroom at 7 p.m.
Well, I have some wonderful images from my travels all over the world, China and Italy, Scotland, Chile, the Arctic. And then I also created a video that demonstrates the role of resonance in the tide, which is really why we have very large tides in one place and not so large tides in other places. And then I tell stories really about how I got started and the kind of the people I encountered along the way.
I'm trying to think of with sound. There's when two sound waves stack on top of each other. They call that, what do they call that? It's like an additive, as opposed to a destructive, phasing. Uh-huh. Is that what you're talking about with resonance, where one force acting on the tides is on top of another one and then it.
Well, that's an interesting way
to
look at it. Yeah. Really, what resonance is about, it's, you know, the tides are a lot of things. And, you know, one of the challenges that I had in my research is that I had to accept that the tide could be one thing and then it could also be something else that apparently seemed paradoxical. But in fact, it's all true that there are many, many layers to this thing. Like, for example, it's true that the tide is a large or a long, low wave that travels around the world at the speed of a modern jet, 450 miles per hour. And we don't experience it as fast moving. You know, we experience this long, slow wave, passing along the coast. Mm-hmm. It also circles around points of no tide. You know, and there are many, many of these kinds of what they call amphidromic systems around the world. And it also feels the bottom. And when it feels the bottom, it really changes. It refracts, it retracts, it reflects, it bounces back on itself. It slows down, it speeds up, it rebounds. It does all these things. So it's kind of crazy making to try to track it sometimes, you know, especially when it comes over the continental shelf into shallower water and then the further up the coast or into the coast. You get typically the further in, the more complex it is. But you can also boil down the subject to vibration and more specifically resonance, which was what we're talking about. And what that has to do with, basically, it's like when you strum a guitar, when you pluck a guitar string, the body of the guitar resonates with that. With that note, it deepens it, it exaggerates, it emphasizes it, it adds richness and complexity. Well, if you blow up the guitar to the size of the solar system, the plucking of the strings are the various relationships of the Earth, Moon, and Sun that have some sort of gravitational signature on Earth, and the guitar body are the various ocean basins of the world. And each guitar body resonates differently with the different notes. So some very excitedly and some not so much at all.
Yeah, and different types of wood are going to have different properties, different grains, a spruce top and a rosewood back and sides are going to... That's really interesting. So if you're just joining us, I'm in the studio with Jonathan White, author of Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. He'll be at the Lovell Showroom at the Fort George Brewery at 14th and Duane this evening in downtown Astoria, talking about his book and offering a presentation. So be sure to catch that at 7 p.m. One of my favorite words I learned in this book is syzygy. So can you tell us about syzygy and what it means? And I guess it comes from the Greek, right?
Yeah, the syzygy, it's a good Scrabble word, right?
Right, yeah, that's a good one.
One of the science textbooks that I used... Written by some British authors, very scientific and heavy book. And yeah, I was amused that at the end in the glossary, there was, you know, probably 10 pages of words in the glossary. And then under syzygy, it said, good Scrabble word.
Yeah. So among other things, listeners, it's syzygy.
Yeah. It's a Greek word meaning yoked together or basically alignment. So when the Earth, you know, the tides really, you know, you can simplify it and say that it's all about the relationship between the moon and the sun, and relative to the Earth, of course. But when the sun and the moon are aligned in syzygy and working together, we have larger tides.
And there's two examples of that. It's perigee and apogee, right?
Well, no, not exactly. It would be when we see the new moon, that means the moon is moon and sun are aligned with the Earth, but the moon is between the Earth and the sun, right? What okay. they call in and then when the moon is full, the moon is on the other side of the Earth, but the sun, Earth, and moon are still aligned in syzygy.
Okay.
Perigee and apogee is when the moon is closer to the Earth or farther away,
which it
does on a two-week cycle. But at any rate, syzygy is an alignment, and that is when we see the largest tides, either new moon or full moon.
So the moon is first, the sun is second, and that's kind of the bulk of it, or there's other major players just to a lesser extent?
There are other players, but much, much to a lesser extent. It's really about the varying relationships of the Earth, Moon, and Sun. And there are over 400 of those that have been identified as having some kind of a tide signature on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I guess the tilt of the Earth causes some of the complexity and the anomalies because the moon isn't just going around the equator, it's going above and then below, and so that tide is following that track to a certain extent. Let's see, that wobble of the Earth, or that tilt of the Earth, causes the precession of the equinoxes, and so that's like a 25,000 plus year cycle, whereas we have our 6 hour low to high, and then 6 hour high to low tide. But I understand some areas only have one tide. How is that possible?
Yeah, I think one of the other interesting things about the history of tide thinking is that especially during the age of discovery in the 15th, 16th centuries, when we were taking off in boats and traveling around the world, there was a lot of interest in finding some kind of a general rule about the tide, something that could be applied everywhere. But in fact, they never really did find it. In fact, we don't have one today. There are general rules, yes, but there are so many anomalies that it's almost an oxymoron. So when you asked about the different, the general rules of the two tides a day, that is a general rule. There are two tides a day, two lows and two highs. But there are places where there's only one tide, like Tahiti, and that's because it's complicated. But it's partly because the sun is playing a very large role in the Pacific. And it's also because, as I mentioned earlier, that the tides wrap around points of no tide. There's a point of no tide very close to Tahiti. And then there are places in the world that have four tides. And there are places that have, on one week, they might have one tide a day. And the next week, they'd have two tides a day, like Biloxi.
Can I talk you into reading a little passage for me?
Sure.
So, let's see. You said page 55... do you want to hit that one?
Sure. This takes place in the second chapter when I went to visit Mont Saint-Michel in France. When I traveled here for the first time, I wanted to meet the monks who live in the abbey. I wanted to ask them about the tide, but they were elusive among the throngs of tourists, their black robes disappearing in a swirl from one small wooden door to the next. When I left France that year, I began a correspondence with one of the abbey guides, who agreed to help me contact the monks. After 2 years and many delicately worded letters, I finally received an invitation to a silent lunch, followed by a half-hour conversation. I know tomorrow I will meet the monks, but tonight I ponder a letter sent earlier from Brother Francois Marie. The abbey, he wrote, is a jewel set in a beautiful case, the bay. Isn't beauty a language through which God and mankind want to meet? If beauty is a language, then Mont Saint-Michel is well spoken tonight. At the western ramparts, where a couple hours ago I had watched the flood's advancing first wave, I now study the ebb tide's fingers withdrawing in the inky light. I'm struck by the different voices I hear in the tide and the monastery. The abbey speaks of human achievement, built painstakingly in service to the Archangel Michael, a guardian and dragon slayer. The monument is an eloquent testament to humanity's insatiable desire for connection and belonging to God, to nature, to other humans. The stone half speaks of permanence, a longing for the eternal. The tide is another kind of eloquence. It's the moon's voice on earth, spoken in perfect synchrony. What the moon does, the tide does. What the moon is, the tide is. Shifting by day but repeating a larger pattern, the tide mirrors the moon's paradox of change and changelessness. In its repetition, it personifies eternity. In its constant flux, it reminds us of what we can't control. It reminds us that our fortresses are impermanent.
Very nice. Very nice, thanks. So that kind of segues into a question that I wanted to ask you. Up in the Bay of Fundy, there are enormous mudflats that appear. And in those mudflats are those, what's the little...
Mud shrimp, yeah.
The mud shrimp, yeah. And then the birds, the sandpipers there, right, mm-hmm. that come once, it's like on their migratory path,
yeah.
it's kind of a refueling stop for them of sorts. And then, and so as, I guess there were some observations about that, and then also in the Abbey at Mont-Saint-Michel, the tourists that kind of come to observe the tide and then leave again. And so there are just kind of these moments in the book where life, living organisms that interact with the tides almost become somewhat indistinguishable from the tides themselves, where, you know, nature is sort of reflecting itself. And I think that that's really a beautiful observation when, you know, when things are dependent on the tides. And, you know, do you have any interesting observations or anecdotes about that concept of just, you know, how important the tides are to the circle of life and all the, you know, from a bottom feeder to a bird, to a mussel, to a human, to a, to a tourist, you know, like.
Yeah, I think, and that's a good observation. I'm fascinated by that. Like when I talked with the monks, they said, this is a UNESCO heritage site, right? Mont-Saint-Michel gets millions of tourists a year. And the monks were observing that the tourists come and go like the tides as well. They swell when the tides are larger.
Mm-hmm.
The hotels are all full. And when during neap tides, they're all gone, right? So everybody wants to be there during the larger tides. And the semi-palmated sandpiper, it's a tiny bird the size of a ping pong ball and almost as light. And it travels all the way from James Bay down to Suriname each year, like 4,000 miles. And it makes one stop. And that's in the Bay of Fundy to feed on these mud shrimp that are exposed during the low tides. And they follow these little birds. They arrive emaciated, and they basically follow the tide line all the way down and all the way back up, eating these little mud shrimp. And one of them eats like 16,000 of them per tide cycle.
Wow.
So it's all very intricately laced together. And even when I talked with some marine biologists about the tidal rhythms, the tide clocks within some of the animals in the intertidal or offshore, or even coastal animals, it's clear that there are many, many, many animals that have these tide clocks. They're tuned to the tides in the way that we are generally tuned to a solar day, and that they know when the tides are coming and going. And it changes every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have some mysterious tide clock within them that's telling them what the tides are doing daily and sometimes what they're doing monthly. And so it's been speculated that, I mean, this is one of the areas that we really don't know a whole lot about. But it's, you know, a lot of us speculate that there are a lot of these rhythms that are at work that we're not aware of, including perhaps tidal and lunar rhythms within human culture itself.
Sure.
So I think we're going to find out a lot about that in the years to come.
That reminds me of some of the concepts behind biodynamic farming, where you're planting according to the lunar cycle, because the water in the seed is pulled out of the shell and up towards the, you know, and that's fascinating stuff to me. Really appreciate that. So I think we're getting close to the end of our time. Is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with? Any last thoughts?
No, not really. I'm happy to be here. It feels like coming home again in some ways.
Great.
And I'm excited about this talk tonight. I love meeting people and sharing this wonderful topic. I mean, it's what's really fascinating about it is that it's so much more complex and mysterious and poetic than any of us ever imagined.
Well, that is tonight at the Lovell Showroom at the Fort George Brewery, 14th and Duane, 7 p.m. Come meet Jonathan White, hear him talk about his book. He'll have slides and a video, and it's guaranteed to be a good time. So that's Tides, the Spirit and Science of the Ocean, Truly an interesting and informative read. The book is entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. There's mythology, cultural histories, geography, astronomy, philosophy, science, poetry, and more. I'm not reading from a script, I swear to God. So thank you so much for being with us on Coast Community Radio, and I wish you the best on the rest of your tour, Jonathan.
Thank you, Graham. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you. So one little epilogue here. I heard that you used to write for your high school paper. Is that right?
That's right.
And that's kind of where you got your start as a as a writer. So we tend to, or we have a relationship with some of the local youth in the high school, both sort of with a musical aspect and a journalism aspect. So what's one tip that you would give to a young journalist? Or an aspiring writer? Author?
Well, I think I'd say stay in practice. It's kind of like an athlete training to be a good basketball player or a surfer or whatever, that you've got to practice. You've got to do a little bit every day.
That's sound advice. So write your morning pages. All right. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.